Welcome to the Weekly Listen, an Engelsberg Ideas podcast brought to you by the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation and produced by Brooke Verlaget Stolper. The Weekly Listen features our essays read by Leighton Pugh.
How to End Wars. Lessons from Iraq. Rolf Ekeus. Two Iraqi wars, one in 1991 and one in 2003, were different both in execution and in terms of law. The only similarity was that in each case, Iraq faced a militarily superior opponent in the form of an international coalition. In historical terms, these two wars will stand out as fundamentally different because of the ways in which the rules for ending them were formulated and, even more importantly, executed. The drama really began with the 1979 revolution in Iran, the deposing of the Shah, and the declaration of the Islamic Republic. The Iranian regime under the Shah had, till then, been a partner and ally of the United States in upholding stability and security in the Persian Gulf, and in countering and balancing the efforts of the Soviet Union to extend its influence in the Middle East, the region where the majority of the world's oil and gas reserves were to be found. Thus, the Islamic Revolution had a direct and functional impact on the grand strategy of the US and its allies in Europe and Asia. For the majority of the Arab states, the emergence of the Islamic Republic of Iran came as a shock, not least to Saudi Arabia, which, although it did not fear the elements of traditional Iran as a Shia Islamic state, was concerned about the new Iranian regime's radical political views. Its attempts to export its revolution and its belief that the Saudi family was an unworthy custodian of Islam's two holy sites, Mecca and Medina. In Iraq, meanwhile, Saddam Hussein saw the radical Shia dimension of the revolution in Iran as a serious challenge to his efforts to uphold an order based upon the secular socialist Ba'ath Party, which kept the country's Shia Muslim majority in check and provided a counterbalance to the Sunni-based tribal groups that constituted his own power base. However, Saddam Hussein could not ignore the extent of negative international reactions to revolutionary Iran, from the US and its Western allies to the Arab states with their overwhelming majority of Sunni Muslims. This created an opportunity for Saddam that he could not pass up. In 1980, he launched his armed forces in a massive attack on Iran, where the regular army, in spite of its numerical superiority, was in disarray after the revolution. But even more significantly, the political isolation of Iran meant that Iraq could count on sympathy and support from large portions of the international community. Thus, the US provided space-based military intelligence, several Western European countries exported military technology, and the Soviet Union delivered military equipment, most particularly huge quantities of middle-range Scud missiles. The Arab states, under the leadership of Saudi Arabia and Kuwait, mobilized financial support in the form of a large solidarity fund to stabilize Iraq's economy and to expand its military capabilities. There was only one state that did not side with Iraq, and that was Israel, which instead provided Iran with some selected military technology. This was a reflection of earlier Israeli strategic thinking, where Iran was counted as a potential and natural strategic partner for Israel in its relations to the Arab Middle East. All this international support, as well as Iraq's frequent and large-scale violation of international law by a massive use of chemical weapons, compensated for the numerical superiority of Iranian forces. After 8 years, the war ended without any significant gains for either of the two combatants. But in political and diplomatic terms, Saddam could not but feel strengthened, having mustered substantial support from both sides in the still ongoing Cold War, as well as from Arab nations. With his newly won international standing, Saddam could see few limits on his freedom of action. Iraq's neighbour, Kuwait, though it had led the Arab Solidarity Fund during the Iran-Iraq War, had long irritated Iraq with its systematic pumping of oil from the joint Iraqi-Kuwaiti oil lakes under the borders between them. On the 2nd of August 1990, Saddam ordered his army to invade and occupy Kuwait. This attack took the world by surprise. All those who had backed Iraq in the war against Iran reacted angrily to Iraq's flagrant violations of the Charter of the United Nations and its provisions prohibiting aggression. Saddam's calculation that the international community would tolerate this attack on his neighbor Kuwait turned out to be a serious error of judgment. The Security Council, with strong American and Arab backing, except for Yemen, condemned the attack in Resolution 678, 1990, imposed economic sanctions, including an embargo on Iraq's oil exports, and endorsed the liberation of Kuwait. A broad international military coalition for the implementation of the resolution was established. Under the combined military leadership of the United States and Saudi Arabia, coalition forces defeated the Iraqi army and liberated Kuwait. At this stage, the Arab members of the coalition made clear that they were not willing to pursue the war against Iraq beyond the UN-mandated liberation. It is important to note this context when assessing the decisions taken by the President of the United States, George H.W. Bush. The US did not insist on any loss of land for a defeated Iraq, nor any form of occupation. Clearly, the strategy was to seek stabilization of the Gulf region and of relations between the major regional actors. An important component in this policy was not to interfere in the internal affairs of Iraq, leaving it to the Iraqis themselves to decide their own future after defeat, but with one major reservation. Iraq was forbidden to hold or acquire any weapons of mass destruction, whether nuclear, chemical, or biological, including middle-range missiles for their delivery, as well as related development and production capabilities. Consequently, Iraq was not prohibited from retaining and keeping conventional weapons, nor from maintaining a functional army and air force. With this approach, it became possible to preserve the military strategic balance in the Gulf between revolutionary Iran and its Arab neighbors. At the same time, the policy of non-interference in Iraq's internal affairs made it possible for the secular Ba'ath Party under Saddam Hussein to remain in power, exercising its brutal control and dominance of the country as the continuing secularization of the political life of the country effectively prevented the breakout of an internal sectarian war between Saddam Hussein's Sunni minority and the Shia Muslim majority. This did not, however, prevent unrest among the Shia opposition in the south breaking out immediately after the end of the Kuwait War, but the revolt was effectively quashed by the Iraqi army. The actual ceasefire in the conflict between Iraq and the Coalition for the Liberation of Kuwait was established in a resolution adopted by the UN Security Council in April 1991 and formally recognized by the government of Iraq. The ceasefire resolution 687, 1991, obliged Iraq to pay compensation to Kuwait for damages caused by the war. But the most politically significant elements of the resolution were the arrangements for the elimination of Iraq's weapons of mass destruction and related production capabilities. Thus, the Security Council established, for the first time, its own subsidiary organ, the Special Commission, UNSCOM. The commission was tasked with providing for the effective implementation of the disarmament dimension of the ceasefire resolution. Furthermore, the resolution stated that when the Council agreed the weapons provisions in disarmament had been fully implemented, the economic sanctions imposed in Resolution 678, 1990, would be lifted. As it was later proved, after the second Iraq War of 2003, between 1991 and 1997, UNSCOM achieved the complete elimination of prohibited biological and chemical weapons and missiles, with a range above 150 kilometres. During the same period, the International Atomic Energy Agency, IAEA, with the support of UNSCOM, accounted for the elimination of all nuclear weapons-related capabilities in Iraq. This did not prevent the later US administrations of Clinton and Bush Jr. from wrongly insisting that Iraq had not fully accounted for all prohibited weapons, and that the administrations were not, therefore, ready to ease the weapons control systems and fully lift economic sanctions against Iraq. In spite of that, a gradual lifting of sanctions helped Iraq's economy to recover during the first years of the new century. The Second Iraq War. After 9/11, Saddam Hussein became an object of anger and suspicion in the eyes of Bush Jr., even if there was no evidence of any Iraqi involvement in these terrorist actions. However, the real American concern was that Saddam could succeed in increasing his influence so that he dominated the Gulf and thus obtained a strong influence on the world's energy markets. To find a legal pretext for preventing an eventual Iraqi aggression against its Arab neighbors, the US administration did its best to prove that Iraq had violated its obligations under the 1991 UN Security Council ceasefire resolution by hiding prohibited weapons of mass destruction. The US could not convince enough members of the Council of this, and therefore failed to muster a Security Council mandate for a legal invasion of Iraq. In spite of the lack of formal endorsement, the US decided to attack Iraq anyway, leading a coalition of the willing that still referred to what it claimed were Iraq's violations of its obligations regarding weapons of mass destruction. The Second Iraq War started in 2003 with massive air raids, followed by an invasion by the American army supported by its selected allies. The invasion was, in military terms, successful, characterized by operations of high mobility and precision weapons, quickly leading to the defeat of the Iraqi armed forces. In 2003, facing a defeated Iraq, mission accomplished, President George W. Bush faced a situation that was, in some respects, similar to the one which had faced his father in 1991. But he took a radically different approach by occupying Iraq with the clear ambition of changing the regime and thus starting a process of reform and democratization of the country. That policy implied more than just the physical elimination of Iraq's president, Saddam Hussein, his sons, and some of his closest collaborators. The most significant action by the new occupying power became the dissolution of Saddam's most important political tool, the secular and socialist Ba'ath Party. By firing all party members from civil state functions, the occupying authority radically changed the balancing structures of the old regime and created massive confusion in all aspects of the administration of the country, as the institutional system of central and local governance disintegrated and the social order collapsed. The elimination of the Ba'ath Party also precipitated a bloody sectarian conflict between the Shia Muslim majority and the Sunni minority. Under Saddam, the latter had enjoyed a protected position, balancing the influence of the Shia. Consequently, the governments set up after the war were all Shia-dominated and ruled the country in a deliberately sectarian style, in which Sunni Muslims were completely without influence. A breakout of terrorist actions and suicide attacks plagued the nation. In addition, the US occupying authority decided to dissolve the Iraqi army. As a consequence, enormous quantities of weapons flooded the country, at the same time as hundreds of thousands of young soldiers became jobless, leaving the army without pay. Without a regular army, the Iraqi authorities installed by the occupying power were unable to counter the violence breaking out all over the country, not least in Anbar province and other locations where the local Sunni population objected to the oppression of the new Shia-dominated authorities. In this situation, new structures and actors with terrorist agendas emerged, some of Wahhabi orientation, radical Saudi-based Sunni Muslims, later developing into the basis for the new Islamic State in Iraq, IS, with roots in al-Qaeda in both Iraq and subsequently Syria, ISIS. Now Iran could make its presence and influence in Iraq felt in support of the Shia-controlled government forces fighting IS terrorists with an agenda to shape a caliphate for the whole Middle East. There are good reasons to reflect on the two Iraq wars and how the victorious forces used their respective positions after the military defeat of the enemy. In Ceasefire Resolution 687, 1991, the Security Council outlined a comprehensive program of disarmament for the first time. Before this, the Security Council, except for a few cases of weapons embargoes, had not touched upon the idea of making disarmament a major element of its security building or peace building decisions. The logic of that practice was based upon the experience of 20th century European history. Whereas the First World War was thought to have been caused by massive overarmament, the Guns of August, the Second World War, at the time of its ending in 1945, was generally attributed to the disarmament of the late 1920s and 1930, leading to the weakening of the military capacity of European democracies. Consequently, the Treaty of Versailles contained far-reaching arms control regulations over Germany, with specific verification arrangements executed by a disarmament control body, the Inter-Allied Control Commission, IACC, the predecessor to UNSCOM. The Covenant of the League of Nations, established by the treaty, made disarmament the foundation of its collective security policy. This functioned reasonably well until the Nazi Party took power in Berlin and the IACC was terminated. In stark contrast, the Charter of the United Nations built its post-Second World War order on the principle of the use of force as a collective and individual response to aggression. In fact, except for a reference in Article 16 and the special functions of the Military Staff Committee in Articles 26 and 27, now fundamentally obsolete, the UN Charter does not contain a word about disarmament. Even such a late international instrument as the 1990 Charter of Paris for a New Europe does not give much space to disarmament, although military confidence-building measures are considered. As it turns out, the disarmament enacted as part of the end of the First Iraq War was a complete success. But this fact was not proven until the US investigations of 2003 to 2005 had been completed after the war. The real problem turned out to be the lack of trust in the UNSCOM inspection regime. The inspectors were right and the doubters were wrong. Instead, the victors of the Second War decided to go for regime change, and the outcome has been a disaster. Iraq and Syria are on the verge of breakup, with their territories to be ruled by one of the most brutal terrorist regimes in history. The policy of regime change from outside has produced fiascos from Iraq to Libya. But in Syria, the opposite policy of preserving the regime, backed by Iran and Russia, has also proven to have disastrous consequences. It has forced large portions of the population to flee and given space and power to terrorists of the so-called Islamic State to recruit and organize large numbers of the Sunni Muslim majority. On the other side, destruction of the regime in Damascus would bring great suffering to the Shia Alawites and the Syrian Christians and further increase the flow of refugees. There is only one way out of total destruction and collapse, which is creative diplomacy. The UN Security Council has agreed to launch a process of negotiations. To end the Syrian war, all relevant parties must come together and look each other in the eye.
Thank you for listening to the Engelsberg Ideas Weekly Listen, read by Leighton Pugh. This podcast was brought to you by the Axel and Margaret Axon-Johnson Foundation and produced by Buchverlaget Stolper. For more writing from the world's leading thinkers on history and culture, featuring essays, historical portraits, and regular podcasts, visit engelsbergideas.com.